The following program contains content that may not be suitable for all listeners.
Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. This is the second of two special shows where we invited repeat storytellers to the Arctic Entries stage.
Our rule had always been that you could only tell one story, but we've mixed things up and made an exception in celebration of 7 years of Arctic Entries.
We recorded these stories over two nights in May 2016 at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts. The title for the shows was The 7 Year Itch, Arctic Entries Through the Years, featuring past storytellers telling new stories.
We'll start the show with a story from Brett Raywalt. Brett says he's essentially a big kid. He's the same height he was in eighth grade, and PB&Js are still a main food staple in his life. Here he takes us back a few years.
Second grade, right? Mrs. Chestnut is my teacher. She's just a sweet little old lady who's been doing this, teaching kids for like 50 years, right? She's encouraging, she's kind, everybody loves her. Unfortunately, at this stage of her career, like working a full week is asking a lot of her. So she only worked a few days a week, and then the other 2 days we would get the backup. We would get Miss Duncan. And Miss Duncan also was really old, but she wasn't sweet, and she certainly wasn't little. She was enormous. We called her Dunkin' Donut. Which I know that sounds really mean, but you have to understand that Miss Duncan was, really vengeful and cruel. So anyway, I don't remember much about second grade, but I do remember that day in vivid detail. Okay, the memories that stay with us from our, early years tend to be traumatic in nature. So you can probably guess who was the teacher that day. Anyway, nothing really exciting happens until after lunch and after recess, and we're back in the classroom, and I raise my hand, and I ask Miss Duncan for a bathroom pass, and she says no. Well, this is a problem, because I have to go now, and I have to go number two. But what am I going to do? Like, she is a monster, and I am a second grader. What do I weigh, like 50 pounds? Like, she seriously probably weighs like 10 times that. That is multiplication. I don't do multiplication yet. I can't even spell multiplication. All I know is that there's a very great disparity between her size and my size, and we're not talking David versus Goliath. We're talking ant versus shoe. So when she says no, that's it. I am becoming more increasingly acutely aware that the seated position that I'm in is really not helping, though. So I utilize the only available means of getting out of my seat, and I go to sharpen the pencil, right? And so I'm sharpening the pencil for like 10 minutes, and it's down to nothing. So I have to go back to my seat, but I have to be really careful here because the situation has now become critical. Okay? As in, the enemy troops are massing at the gates of the city, and they are pounding on the door. So in absolute desperation, I raise my hand again. Miss Duncan, can I please go to the bathroom? No. You're just looking for an excuse to get out of your seat. I thought about making a break for it. Okay? For all her size, I am much more agile. If I get to the door first, I'm gone. Hit the bathroom on the way back, maybe go by the principal's office, let him know that he has a second grade teacher, won't let any of his kids go to the bathroom. Her great cruelty would be exposed. We'd be rid of her forever. I would be a hero. Unfortunately, at this point of the game, my running ability is a serious question mark. And I'm sorry, but I'm just too young to die. So I'm pooping. And I'm doing it as quietly as possible. And I'm also like kind of worried that my classmates will notice that I am sitting slightly higher up in my seat. Okay? But amazingly, like, nobody hears anything. Nobody notices the change in elevation. I must be an amazing actor because I am filling my pants in the middle of the classroom, and I'm embarrassed and I'm relieved. But nobody is catching on. I am totally stoic. Unfortunately, my acting ability cannot mask the smell. It's bad. And there's no passing this off as a fart. So, like, all the kids knew that somebody had pooped their pants. Amazingly, nobody suspected one person who just got shot down twice after asking to go to the bathroom. Oh, but two kids did start going through the aisles, sniffing to find the source of the smell. So, thinking quickly, I joined them in the search. And this helps to distribute the smell throughout the classroom until the teacher tells everybody to sit down again. But amazingly, I escaped detection. Okay, after this, it's mostly just a bunch of uncomfortable sitting, followed by an even more uncomfortable walk home. I live like 3 blocks from the school, but it feels like 3 miles. And I'm walking like a cowboy. This is like an early childhood version of the Walk of Shame. I was trying really hard to do this whole story without using any wordy dirds, but there's no way around it. This is it's just a really shitty day, man. Okay, so I really don't want to talk to my parents about this when I get home. So I destroyed all the evidence, and they never found out. But here's the twist. That night, I went to my bedroom, and I had a drawing pad and a pencil, and I drew a picture of Miss Duncan. And like at this point, like I could draw Snoopy pretty good, you know? But I wasn't copying off of anything this time. I was creating something entirely new. I was drawing her face from memory, and like in a realistic way, and but then I fused it to like this grotesque science fiction blubberous something, and it was hideous and disgusting and vile, but it looked just like her, and it was awesome. I cannot properly describe for you how satisfying it felt to to draw this. I didn't even know that I could do that, but I discovered the power of art. Where I felt so powerless before, like now I had a victory over my nemesis because of this picture. So after that, like I'm drawing all the time. Art becomes my thing. I've drawn probably like every teacher I've ever had. And you know, I entered contests, I actually got a scholarship, and fast forward to today, and I've been working as a graphic artist now for almost 30 years. So, Miss Duncan is dead, I presume. I do feel, you know, safer telling the story now because of that. But that day could have been a huge scar in my life. And instead, I look at that as that's the day that my career began. So I'm not bitter. I'm thankful. God bless you, Miss Duncan. I hope you rest in peace.
That was Brett Raywald, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme is Arctic Entries Through the Years. We're celebrating 7 years of 7-minute true stories on the Arctic Entries stage.
Lots of Anchorage residents, especially local music fans, have seen our next storyteller around town. He plays upright bass for the Super Saturated Sugar Strings and hosts the popular Parlor in the Round event.
Here's Kevin Worrell on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
When I was 23, I discovered my voice as a songwriter. I'd been passionate about music my whole life, but when I wrote those first songs, I feel like I had discovered my calling. It was so clear to me that I needed to play those songs for as many people as possible, and I took that calling very literally. I got in a 1972 GMC. I'm talking box. This thing should not have driven past the dump, and I went ahead and put everything I owned in the back of it, and I drove it across the country. And part of this was to prove this notion, to test it out, that if we're doing what we're truly called to do, that somehow we'll be provided for, and that things will just work out. And I believe that was true, and I wanted to see. And so about 6 days later, I'm sitting in a parking lot in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm paralyzed with fear. I've got just about enough money to put some gas in my tank. I'm sitting on three songs that I'd written, and I got a little bit of food left, and I can't move. What was I thinking? This wasn't a calling. This was some like childhood fantasy that had gone unchecked, and now here I am 1,000 miles from home, no way to get back and out of ideas. So I took a nap, and then I took another nap, and then I ate the rest of my food, and then when I was all out of things to do, I had to give up. And so I said my best surrender prayer. I said, "F it." And I put the truck in drive, and I started to roll, and something happened at that moment. I felt this fire down in my belly, and I didn't know what was going to happen from there or how it was going to work out, but I just knew what I needed to do was to continue on that path and that it was going to work. Well, I just kept following the fire, and the dream life rolled out in front of me. By the time I was 27, I'd crossed the country back and forth that way several times. I graduated to a motorcycle. In fact, I even did a stint in Mexico that way. I'd put together enough songs now that I could make my first record, so I came back to Alaska to make some money and get to the studio. I was in my last hitch on the slope before coming down to get into that studio, and I called up a woman who I had been romantically involved with for a short time, and we decided that we were better off as friends. And I called to check in on her, and her voice was shaky, and she said, "When you come home, we need to talk." And I knew what she was going to say, and I felt my whole life slow down to a stop, and everything got quiet. And then through her own tears, she said, "I know how important music is to you, and I would never ask you to give up on your life's dream, and I've made a decision that I'm going to raise this baby that we're going to have by myself." And what I said to her was, "Well, you don't know me very well. However, I would never miss the opportunity to be a father." And so in that moment, standing there like in the public telephone in the slope camp, we had this little moment of connection and hope. And there was, something like, we don't know what the hell we're going to do, but we're going to do it together. Unfortunately, the reality continued to set in as the sleepless days packed on, and I felt fear and remorse and anger and shame. I promised myself that I would never raise a child in a two-household family. And here I was looking at living exactly that and seeing no way out. I was looking at this life that I had been gifted the opportunity of to do what I felt called to do and have it work. And now I feel like I had blown the opportunity. And while this should have been a really joyous time in my life, despite the unplanned circumstances, I just felt devastated. And somewhere under the crush of all those emotions, that fire just extinguished. So I did what any father-to-be would do at that point. Full steam ahead to Mexico. That's all right. I had a game plan. I had a full break from reality. I said, "Okay, I'm going to finish this record. I'm going to retrace my steps to Cabo San Lucas, where I had a nice little song down there that did well. I'm going to sell out every copy that I have. I will return a quasi rock star in the Mexican pop charts, and I will then figure out this dad thing when I get back." And so off I went, and I was going to relive all the glory from the road. In fact, I went out on that motorcycle, and I was waiting for the glory to rain down upon me, and fans writing, "Kevin, you're so brave of you to go out there and do this." And instead, people were like, "What are you doing?" You got a kid coming. What I did meet was floods in Napa Valley. And I just pushed through and I said, "I'm going." And I can tell you, if you want like a full break from reality, don't plan a 2,000-mile solo motorcycle trip. I was locked inside my helmet with an egomaniac, a self-loathing a-hole, and like a lawyer in there who was trying to like find some moral loophole to justify the whole experience. It's crazy. By the time I got to Mexico, I was completely out of my mind, and suffice it to say, here's my pinnacle of rock stardom down there. Picture me in a bar all by myself, where I heard one of my songs playing from the bar DJ, because in order to play the song, I promised that I would buy a beer. And then I promptly passed out. It's classy. So by the time that trip was done, I was spent, and all the fight was out of me. And actually, I felt a little bit relieved to have failed on whatever I was trying to do, because at least I had some sense of direction, because I was completely lost in my life. I just didn't understand how this life that I knew I was called to do somehow couldn't work how I knew it was supposed to. And so I knew I just needed to go home, and I felt like I was going back to like a prison sentence. And so I just headed north. And I remember I was traveling out of Fort Nelson, Colorado. It was about 70 degrees in the morning. And as I climbed through the hills into Wyoming, it got cold and the rain started to come down, and then the rain started to come down sideways. And as the sun went down, the rain turned to snow. And I'm out there in the middle of nowhere, and there's no place to hide, no place to get out of the weather. I'm hypothermic, not thinking clearly, and I'm about 6 miles out of Evanston, Wyoming. And I come to a big ravine called Two Sisters. It's a massive hill, and my best thinking says that I need to go as fast as this motorcycle can possibly go and knock down these 6 miles and just get some shelter. So as I moved down that hill, I passed 70 and 80 miles an hour. I passed 90. As I came up the other side of the massive hill, I tipped over 100 miles an hour. There's a large truck coming in the oncoming direction. And I thought to myself, like barely conscious, I need to slow down, because when I wreck, I'm going to die. And so I managed to get the bike slowed down enough. And sure enough, I think I found a patch of black ice. And the bike began to swish back and forth from one side to the other, and I did my best to try to recover, but there was no bringing it back. And eventually I slid out, and here I was skipping down I-80 on my back, and I can see the headlights swinging back and forth in the snow, and there's a rainbow of sparks coming off the gas tank and off the exhaust pipes. And I'm just kind of watching this whole thing unfold in front of me, and then this thought occurs to me. What am I doing out here? I'm going to be somebody's father. And then another thought occurs. I'm sliding for a really long time. So I had time to kind of put all this together. And the fear and the shame and the remorse all started to melt away. And I had this, like, you know, I stopped feeling cold. And I started feeling like I can do this as soon as I stop sliding. And so eventually, like, the slide slowed down, and I rolled up onto my feet and ran and got my motorcycle. And, you know, I woke up in a hotel room the next day, and I grabbed my surroundings and realized where I was. And I felt that thing in my stomach. The fire had returned. And I felt very clearly the call of what I was supposed to do. I'm supposed to go be the best dad that I can be. So I hustled for Alaska. I jumped in with both feet into the fatherhood and did the best I could. And I haven't looked back since. The 10 years since that time has brought me incredible adventure. And I'll tell you that the desire to get on the road has not quieted one bit. But I wouldn't trade a single moment of fatherhood for any life on the road. And I just followed that fire, and the dream life rolled out in front of me. I want to dedicate this story to my baby mama and her new fiance in the audience tonight, and say a belated Happy Mother's Day. Thanks.
That was Kevin Worrell, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. We're hearing true stories told by Alaskans.
Jamie Patterson-Symes lives and breathes aviation and spends a ton of time scrubbing the grease out from underneath her fingernails. She's learned quite a few things since she first started flying small planes in Alaska back in 1995.
Okay, so as a pilot, it's really, really important that it's all about the hours. And the hours that you gain, and the hour, every flight hour and every flight hour that you fly is really important for you to move on to the next step. And with that in mind, I decided to be a pilot in Bethel, Alaska. So I went out to Bethel, and within 2 hours after landing, I landed a job. And there were about 140 pilots working the line out there. And when I got hired, I doubled the amount of female pilots from one to two. So now there were two of us. There was Kathy and myself. At first, I was on a very short leash, and my chief pilot gave me the smallest airplane that they could. It was a little Cessna 172, had four seats, and I plied the river up and down the Kuskokwim, carrying mail and passengers and cargo, and I would go from Eat to Tuntutuliak to Kongiganak to Quingilingok to Atbathluk to Kastigluk to Akyachuk, up and down the river. And I knew that I could not compete with these guys. I had to prove myself all the time to all these male pilots. And they were all looking at me, just waiting for me to fail. And I wasn't going to. So after a few weeks of flying up and down the Kuskokwim, I would hear in the background in our dispatcher's office the HF radio start crackling. And they would say, "Send lady pilot. She's nice. She smells good. She's smooth." So I became the smooth lady pilot, and I got lots of jobs. One day, my chief pilot came up to me and he said, "Yo, Jamie, you got to pick up in Queethluck. There are three guys. You need to go pick them up out there." I said, "Okay, no problem." And I grabbed the manifest. And since it was one of my last gigs for the day, I went out and I walked out to the airplane. And I noticed that in the distance, there were these gathering storm clouds. And they were getting really low, and they were getting darker and darker. And the wind was really picking up. It was starting to blow my hair around, my ponytail. And I got a little worried, but there was no way. This was only 12 miles to Queethluck. I could get there and back, be back in a half an hour. And so I taxied out and got takeoff clearance and started, and I got to about 500 feet, and I knew I had made an egregious error in judgment. The airplane started rocking back and forth, and sheets of rain started coming across the windscreen. In fact, the seals around the windscreen were so poor that the wind and the rain started coming in and leaking in through the window, and my face was getting wet. So I made it to Queethluck in this storm, and I landed splash, splash, splash down this rutted, muddy runway, and mud was coming up over the windscreen, over the wings, and the runway was only 35 feet wide. The wingspan of the aircraft was actually hanging over, was over the width of the runway. So I taxied in, and I went to our little turnout, and I shut down the airplane, and I noticed the three guys over there standing in the shelter. And I got out and I said, "Come on, hurry up. We've got to get back to Bethel. Hurry up, get in the airplane." And all three of them just stood there, just stunned, didn't say one word. And one of them was actually smoking a cigarette and has his jaw dropped open. The cigarette that was dangling from his lips dropped into the mud. I didn't need this. I just need to get back to Bethel. So they finally got into the airplane, and they buckled themselves in. The guy buckled himself next to me, two in the back, and the passenger next to me. And I hit the key, and I taxied out and made my radio call for takeoff. And I took off into this darkening gloom. And so I got the automated weather for Bethel, and they said, "Bethel Airport closed to all VFR traffic. Please contact Bethel Tower on 118.7. Do not enter the Class Delta airspace." Oh, awesome. So at that point in time, I started to smell a little bit of an odor next to me. And I noticed that I took a little sniff and realized the guy next to me had been drinking. And so I had a few choices here. I could continue on to Bethel, or I could turn back to Queethluck and let these guys off, and I would never live that down. So I made a call to Bethel Tower, and they said, "Yeah, we need you to hold outside the Bethel airspace, and we'll call you when we can get you in." I said, "Okay, no problem. There's three airplanes holding already. You can join them in the fourth one." So pretty soon I found the holding pattern with the other airplanes, and pretty soon three other airplanes joined us, and there were seven of us all together. We were going in a circular racetrack pattern about 500 feet off the deck, and we were trying to keep our plane steady in the rain, but I had a really heavy load with three big guys, and I was in a real small airplane. And we were trying to keep the aircraft in front of us in sight. We're following the red beacon of each of us, of the other aircraft. And as we went round and round, the guy next to me started to get a little bored. And he put his arm around the back of my shoulders and started squeezing me. I elbowed him in the ribs and kept flying. And then he put his hand on my leg and started rubbing my thigh. And I was like, he was interfering with the rudders. I was kind of getting a little mad at this point. And it was a little bit of craziness inside the airplane, too, because Bethel Tower was talking to us, and all seven pilots were going air-to-air frequency. And we were all trying to follow this airplane in front of us, and the wind was blowing like crazy. Finally, he put his hand over mine on the throttle, and I'd had it. I was so mad. And so I always kept my leather gloves between my knees. And so I reached down with my right hand, and I eased my right hand into my right leather glove, and I put it on as tight as I could. And I balled up my fist, and his friends in the back were screaming at him to leave him alone. And with all my anger, I took my fist, and I yelled out a real bad expletive, and I said, "Ugh! Take that, leave me alone." And his head ricocheted off the window. And he screamed and he howled in pain as he held his eye. And all I could do was just keep on flying, because that's the most important thing, is the safety of flight. About 20 minutes later, they called us. The tower contacted us, and told us that we could land. And so all seven of us landed in a train, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, one after the other. And I taxied in to our terminal and let those three guys out. And I decided to take a few minutes out of the airplane because, well, I'm sure that that punching a passenger is probably a firing offense. So I wanted to get fired out on the ramp rather than inside in front of all my coworkers. So I waited out there for a little while, tied down the airplane, and nobody came out. And so I went inside and went in through the door, and the two dispatchers were behind the counter and kind of looked at me. One of them kind of looks at me up and down, didn't say a word, neither of them said anything, and one of them kind of raised his eyebrows. A few minutes later, my chief pilot comes in. He said, "Yo, Jamie, how'd it go?" I'm like, fine. He's like, "Everything okay?" I'm like, "Awesome, it's great." He's like, "Okay, good to hear it," and walked off. So the next morning dawned bright and early, beautiful day, first flight of the day. I'm going to go out and pre-flight the airplane. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. And as I'm walking past the hangar, I noticed a figure crouched on the ground, sitting on the ground with his back pressed against the hangar. And he had his head on his knees like this. And as I walked by him, he could hear my footsteps. And he looked up, and my eyes met his one good right eye, because his left eye was black and purple and swollen shut. He didn't say anything. He did, but it's not repeatable. So anyway, thank you so much for listening.
You just heard from Jamie Patterson-Symes. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our next storyteller, Roman Dial, moved to Alaska when he was 16. He and his family are great adventurers, both in Alaska and around the world. For many years, they have shared their stories online through their travel and adventure blog called The Roaming Dials. He tells this story in May 2016, live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
Well, there's a lot of stories I'd rather tell than this one, but this seems like the only one that really matters. Our son, Cody Roman Dial, he disappeared in Costa Rica in 2014. And Cody Roman, he was conceived in a tent in the Brooks Range, and he was born in February in Fairbanks. And when he was 6 years old, he and I walked across Umnak, which is a remote Aleutian island, just the two of us, 60 miles in a week. And after that, he always introduced himself as Roman. So in elementary school, Roman, his sister Jazz, and his mom Peggy and I, we traveled all over the world visiting rainforests and coral reefs and deserts. And when he was in high school, he helped me with some of my research projects. Jazzy and Roman skied around the Harding Ice Field with me for a week, counting ice worms. He took 2 months off of school and went to Borneo and helped me in the rainforest canopy. In high school and college, we did pack rafting all over the state. We pack rafted in Malaysia, Australia. We even did the Grand Canyon together. And in fact, the last time that I saw him, we met down in Mexico with a bunch of friends and pack rafted these waterfalls down there. And he was starting this 7-month trip through Latin America. So on his trip, he would email us and he'd tell us about watching monarch butterflies in the Sierra Madre or sea turtles on the Pacific swimming with whale sharks in the Caribbean. And he got down to Guatemala and he wrote me this email and he said, Dad, I'm going to do this 200-kilometer, 10-day solo walk along the border of Mexico and Guatemala to visit these Mayan ruins. And I wrote him back. I wrote him this email, and I said, no, don't do that, Roman. That sounds too dangerous. But I didn't send that email. I deleted it, and I wrote him. I said, well, be careful with the machete and watch out for snakes. So he did that trip and he wrote another email about it. It was like 6,000 words long. It was an amazing story. And I liked it so much, I sent it to all of my friends who'd seen Roman grow up. And it kind of set this pattern for what he would do for the rest of his trip. He would write us an email and say, here's what I'm going to do. And he'd say, I got back and I'll write you more tomorrow. And then he'd write this really great story about his adventures. After about 7 months, he wrote me from Costa Rica and asked about maps. He wanted to know if I knew where he could get some topo maps. And I said, yeah, maybe, yeah, here, try this. And then I took off on my own trip to the Tauquitinas to go pack rafting. And then I came back and we went dip netting on the Kenai. And I checked my phone and I didn't see anything. Just that thread about the maps. And Peggy and I were coming back from the Kenai and we stopped to do some grocery shopping and we were talking about why haven't we heard from Roman? And she's like, God, I feel really nauseous. So we went home and I dove into these emails that I'd been collecting and I went to that thread, buried in that thread about topo maps, was this email from Roman and he said, hey, I'm going into Corcovado National Park, which is the biggest wilderness area in Costa Rica. I'm going into Corcovado by myself for 5 days, and I'm going to bushwhack because I don't want to hire a guide. I don't have enough money to hire a guide. And the last words on the email were like, there'll be a trail to the west of me and coastline on the other sides, and it should be difficult to get lost forever. And the email was two weeks old, and he was 10 days overdue. And I immediately called the American Embassy in Costa Rica, and I emailed Corcovado National Park, and I asked my friend Ty Verzoni to drop everything, to, drop his job, drop his wife, and, leave his 2-month-old baby and come with me to Costa Rica to look for my son. So we flew down there, and I thought we'd just be there for 10 days, and I ended up staying 40 days. And when we got there, the very first night, Ty and I walked through the town, and I found the hostel where Roman had stayed, and he had his yellow bag was there that he'd left behind, the things he didn't need for the jungle. And a few days later, Ty found some miners who had encountered Roman on this illegal mining trail in the jungle, cooking breakfast on this like jet boil stove. And the authorities there in Costa Rica, they wouldn't let me go into the jungle. But I snuck in, I went anyway. And it was really hot and humid and it rained and it felt dangerous. One time Ty stepped over a log on the trail, it was about this high, and coiled up on the log was this green viper. And Ty had stepped like right over it and didn't see it. And Ty went back to his family and some other friends, Brad Micklejohn and Todd Tumalo, they came down to help me, and there were like, you know, more snakes, you know. Todd pretty much just about walked into a viper hanging in a bush. And we, other friends came down, they didn't really know what they were getting into, and we would rappel down into these green slot canyons that would flash flood, because I thought maybe Roman had slipped into one of these inaccessible places. One night there was a horrible rainstorm, and this tree came down. It was like a 150-foot tree, and it landed just a few yards away from the one of our tents with three people inside, and it felt really dangerous. And I realized this is why the authorities didn't want me in the jungle, and I didn't want my friends in the jungle. It was just too much. But the landscape, when you look at the mountains, they look really smooth, but you get up in them, and they're just all folded up in a maze of steep ridges and these narrow canyons. And I would walk up the ridges and down the creeks yelling, "Roman!" You know, but we didn't find anything. Nothing. Peggy came down, and we walked the exact route that Roman had described in an email, like over the peninsula, all off trail and all illegal, and we're sneaking back along the beach in the dark. And Peggy says, "He's not in the jungle. Somebody took him." There'd been like this persistent story that Roman had gotten together for 3 days and walked across the peninsula with this guy who was a drug dealer and a thief. And it just didn't add up. Like, Roman had written me, he didn't want to go with any guides. And he was doing his own thing. And I'd already met these miners who, you know, said, "Hey, I saw Roman over here, and I couldn't figure out why would Roman be over there." And at this point, I had to get an American investigator involved. I needed somebody who could speak Spanish and push buttons and find answers. So I picked this retired DEA agent. He'd worked in Latin America for 25 years, and his name is Carson, and he's like 10 feet tall and super muscular and bald, and he's got tattoos, and he's just scary to talk to. And he was the kind of guy that could sniff out criminals and get them to talk. So I spent 7 weeks with Carson last year, 7 weeks down there sitting down with these suspects, these people who probably killed our son, had a beer with them, offered them reward money, pretended like I didn't know they were involved to try to get them to help find our son's body, because without the body in Costa Rica, there's really no case. I did find one piece of evidence in January. I was there with Costa Rican investigators and some cadaver dogs deep in the jungle, and I had gotten in the habit of looking underneath of miners' tarps and in their tents and things to see if I could find anything of Roman's, and there was a foam pad, a little piece of a foam pad that I'd given him when we'd been pack rafting in Mexico. And I was like, "Holy cow, that's the first thing I found." And it turns out that the miner who was mining right next to this tarp, he had lived with the mother of our primary suspect. But that's the only piece of evidence that we've had. It took a whole year to get this case elevated from a missing persons to a homicide. It could be another year before they arrest anybody as a suspect, but I don't know, it may be never. And I'm tired, really. I'm exhausted going down there. I've spent, you know, 6 months of the last year and a half searching. And the bummer is that I don't want to go down anymore. But if I don't go down, if I'm not present, then nothing really happens. So that's all I got to say.
Thanks to Roman Dial for sharing that story with us. Since this story was told in May 2016, Cody Roman Dial's passport and backpack were found near skeletal remains in a Costa Rican ravine. For updates and more information on this story, visit the Roaming Dials website at packrafting.blogspot.com.
This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour, and our show is a little different this month. We're featuring repeat storytellers. This means we gave past storytellers a chance to come back to the stage and tell another true story about themselves. You can find all these storytellers' previous stories in our archives at arcticentries.com.
Our next storyteller's daddy was a beatnik and his mommy was a belly dancer. Born in Minnesota and raised without boundaries, Orion Donnacht has become an Anchorage favorite as he plays music and bartends around town.
In 1997, I was a roadie for the Rolling Stones. I was 22 years old. I'd been doing road work for a little over a year. I'd done all kinds of things. Ozfest, Lilith Fair, Last Chance Summer Dance with NSYNC, Lollapalooza, Doobie Brothers, Engelbert Humperdinck. On and on the list goes, et cetera, et cetera. But the Rolling Stones, that was the holy grail of roadie work. Came out of retirement to work that. Everybody wanted to be a roadie for the Rolling Stones. So when they came to town and they were asking around, they said they needed some more people for the crew, man, I jumped on. The stage for the Bridges to Babylon tour that year was the largest stage in rock and roll history. Just over 90 feet tall. It was built in a giant factory in Belgium, and the engineers that designed it and fabricated it lived there and slept and ate in the factory, and they lived with those stages. They were there since birth, for all I know. And when those stages traveled and crisscrossed the whole world in a logistical nightmare, making the tour work smoothly, little pods of Belgian guys were with each stage, telling the other 70 chuckleheads what to do, and I was one of the chuckleheads. Simultaneously, U2 was doing the Pop Mart tour. You may recall the single giant golden arch on their stage, making it the biggest rock and roll stage in rock and roll history, over 90 feet tall. I know, it's weird. They were built by the same Belgian company and staffed by the same crew of dudes that I was with. So you're doing U2 one night, and then you drive a couple days, and you go do the Rolling Stones in another town, and then you go drive a couple days, and you do U2 in another town, and you had to show up at this hotel on a certain day to get on the list, and you show up, and they'll pay you 3 gas receipts when you get there. I don't know. Something must have happened to make it so they only pay 3 of your gas receipts. So make sure you fill up. Don't just top that shit off. 3 gas receipts. You get your key to your room. It was always 3 dudes to a room. We would get the whole hotel. The entire crew would take over a hotel in, let's say, Fort Worth, Texas. And we had every room, and it was 3 guys to a room, and the youngest, most innocent guy, which was always me, got the blanket on the floor or the trundle bed, depending. We'd have the whole hotel, and we'd have a room where the escorts were, and they had business cards. And I was a young, innocent, and handsome roadie, and I didn't have any need for escorts, and they recognized that, and they didn't even give me a business card. And there's another guy following us from town to town, and he'd set up in a hotel room, and he had lots of drugs for sale, and we'd pass on to each other what room he was in, and then you'd go down there, and you'd go shopping. It was like a very smoky drug depot. And we rolled that way from city to city, and I made a bunch of great friends. Here was the other thing I wanted to say. On the days you worked, you got 3 catered meals from their, they had a catering company on site, and it was awesome food. And you pigged out because on the days you didn't work, you didn't eat, you just drank. So on these days you didn't work, you're drinking, you're making excellent friends. You know, nothing brings guys together like hunger and alcohol. And I made a couple very close friends, Sean Donner, who I'm still in touch with to this day, is a long-haired, gentle soul, hippie guy with a big plate in his head. His best friend was Sean Johnson from Atlanta, Georgia, and he looked like a teenage Lando Calrissian, and he talked like Andre 3000, and that was in 1997. And Andre 3000 wasn't even around. We were like, wow, this guy's amazing. So I hooked up with those dudes. We took a little side trip from the Rolling Stones tour. We went back to Atlanta where their hometown was, and we did Fleetwood Mac, the dance tour in Atlanta. And I was watching from backstage as Stevie Nicks took off her shawl and she let it drift off into the security pit during one of them weird songs. And it floated down into the mud, and I kept watching that shawl, and nobody came back for it. And then breakdown came, and I came out, and it was still sitting there, and I picked it up, and I tied it around my neck. I figured some manager would come, give me that, and I'd have to give it back, but nobody ever did. And I just carried that around with the shift, and I ended up bringing that shawl home and gave it to my mom in Minnesota for Thanksgiving. So the Rolling Stones are doing a show Thanksgiving night in Minneapolis, where most of my family lives. We buzz up from Atlanta. I got the shawl from Stevie Nicks. We do the whole setup. It's a 3-day setup to get the stage all built. You know, we're hanging out. And Thanksgiving night comes. The Rolling Stones are playing the Metrodome. We had watched the show every time. And I will say the Stones were better every time I watched them. They were loosening up, or the drugs were kicking in, or the lidocaine shots or whatever they're putting in Keith's knees. kicking in, but that on Thanksgiving night, I said, you guys, let's not watch the show. Let's go have Thanksgiving dinner at my grandma's house. So I brought Donner, and I brought Sean, and we hooked up with my buddy Toke, who you've never seen anybody like this guy, Toke. I swear to God, he's 6'6", crazy Muppet hair. One eye was bigger than the other, and he had green teeth. I had never actually seen green teeth. It was like he was always eating spinach. You'd always meet him 5 minutes after he ate a bunch of spinach. And we had Sparrow was with us. She had her own car. So we're like, yeah, come have Thanksgiving with us, Sparrow. And she was like one of them tough. You know, it's a very archetypical type of female who hangs out on a road crew and a rock and roll tour. I'm sure you can imagine. We go have grand Thanksgiving dinner at my grandma's house. It's wonderful. My grandma prepares her Norwegian favorite, 5 different kinds of meat, and then some potatoes on the side. We have a fantastic Thanksgiving dinner is a wonderful blessing, but we got to get to Detroit for the next show. We got to be at the hotel the next day in Detroit to make our check-in. So we leave directly from my grandma's house, and we start driving to Detroit. I'm in the rental car, the Dodge Intrepid that Donner's mom was nice enough to sign off for because none of us had old enough, I guess. And Donner's next to me, Toke's in the backseat, and Sparrow and Sean Johnson are in her Blazer. We're driving through Clinton County, Wisconsin at 3 in the morning on Thanksgiving night in 1997. We get pulled over by this troopers, they're the sheriffs in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin. The female trooper knocks on Sparrow's car window. Sparrow rolls it down. The female trooper says, I thought I saw you go over the yellow line. Have you been drinking? And Sparrow politely turns to her and says, I've been sober 5 years. You want to call my sponsor? Turns out the cop did not want to call her sponsor. But she did want to search our cars. And Wisconsin is a zero-tolerance state. So three arrests later, me and Toke and the 5 troopers are standing there talking. Toke had dropped all his stuff in a little rip in his jacket. And I had my weed stuffed in a tape case on the floor with like 100 other tape cases. And I had a little 10-strip of acid wedged in a book on the seat next to me. And the cops let us follow him back to town. We get back to town. It's like 6 in the morning. We got to wait for the office to open at 7. We had enough cash to bail out Sparrow. Sparrow had a credit card. She bailed out Donner. But they would not let Sean Johnson go. They kept him on a warrant for breaking and entering out of Atlanta, which later turned out to be a clerical error. And they held him in jail for over a year. And he missed Christmas with his kids. And I still don't like Wisconsin. Later that day, we're driving into Michigan over the Mackinac Bridge. And it's a beautiful sunny day. And we're flying in this car, and we're surrounded by cops. I am seeing them everywhere. And in Michigan, they got the big Keystone copper bulbs on top, and literally, they are everywhere around our car all the time. And I'm really freaking out, and I turn to Donner, and I said, hey, Donner, man, I got to get rid of this acid, man. He says, hey, man, you're going to throw it out the window? I said, hell no, man. I'm going to take that. So 30 hours after I woke up, some of those hours were Thanksgiving dinner, some of those hours were building a stage for the Rolling Stones, I dropped 10 hits of acid in the cab of a very small rental car driving into Michigan. I don't know if you've ever taken acid, but I went off like a rocket! Woo! A couple hours later, we're rolling into Detroit. I'm crawling in there like a laboratory monkey. Detroit Rock City comes on the radio. I was twisting that volume knob till it was about to twist off there. I was smoking that thing. I want to feel the music. We roll up into the Ramada Inn in downtown Detroit. And due to another clerical error, I ended up with an executive suite all to myself with a California split king bed and an entertainment system and a 4-foot by 4-foot window sliding over downtown Detroit City. I leaned out and I said, I don't think you know how important we are. We're roadies for the Rolling Stones. After that, but wait, there's more. So we had to, we did the show in Detroit. We had to take the rental car back to Atlanta. We take the show back. We got one more show in Atlanta with the Rolling Stones. I drop the rental car off. I say goodbye to all my newfound friends. I get on a Greyhound bus and I cruise back to Minneapolis. My dad picks me up at the Greyhound station. He was very disappointed that I was $400 in the hole. He was very disgusted that I'd somehow sprouted dreadlocks all over the back of my head from sleeping on floors and using Dr. Bronner's for shampoo. But I know he's a little bit jealous because he said to me, before I had the chance to say it to him, I bet you do that all over again.
That was Orion Donick on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Becky Wint Pearson has been, among other things, a lawyer, a teacher, a campaign organizer, and a travel writer. Longtime Arctic Entries fans might remember her as the cheeseburger on stage during the October 2011 Spooked show. This is her second story. As we said earlier, we're making an exception to allow for repeat storytellers on this show as we celebrate 7 years of Arctic Entries history. Here's Becky.
So for my story tonight, I'd like to take us all back to a slightly less insane election season, to a year when the candidate with the hair was not Donald Trump, but was instead a smooth-talking trial attorney turned senator from North Carolina named John Edwards. Now, most of us probably remember how the John Edwards story ended with voters. You know, there was the mistress, and then there was the illegitimate child, and then there was a whole, you know, unfortunate situation with 6 felony counts of violating federal election law. But before all of that went down, there was a time when a lot of Democrats really liked John Edwards and really liked what he had to say and hoped that he might be a front runner for the presidential nomination in 2008. Not me, though. I like to think I was ahead of the game and realizing that John Edwards was probably a schmuck. Why? Because I once spent an afternoon digging a grave with John Edwards. A grave for a dog who was not yet dead. But I should start at the beginning. So in 2003, I was in my early 20s, and I was teaching middle school in inner city Boston and growing increasingly frustrated with national policies that I saw, leaving my students without access to health care and with siblings shipping off to war every week. And so I did what any self-respecting idealist in their early 20s should do, and I sold everything that I owned that didn't fit in my Dodge Neon. And I turned my car north, and I drove to New Hampshire to work for the Howard Dean campaign. Screaming. So 7 months later, Dean screamed in Iowa, and I was laid off. And all of that is another story for another day. But in the meantime, I ended up living in a politically important early primary state with a lot of political connections and a decent amount of political experience. You know, I'd sat in a smoky room with John Kerry while he unsuccessfully tried to relate to the voters of northern New Hampshire with stories of childhood ski excursions, and I'd conversed with Joe Lieberman's epic jowls, and I had seen the legitimate splendor that was John Edwards' hair glistening in the afternoon sun. So from the beginning, John Edwards always seemed like a little bit much to me. He was like a little too shiny and a little too smooth, and I was a Howard Dean girl through and through in 2004. But fast forward 2 years to 2006, and the Neon and I were still in New Hampshire. We'd traded, you know, presidential politics for steady employment working at Dartmouth College with undergraduate students on community service projects. And John Edwards was starting his Promise and Opportunity Foundation, and he was talking about poverty in ways we hadn't heard from other candidates on the left. And so when two of my students came to me and asked if I might help them set up a community service project that they could do with John Edwards while he was on campus starting his, you know, the Dartmouth chapter of his foundation, I said, sure, and I'm happy to help. So I made some calls, and I reached my buddy Daniel, who ran a nonprofit that completed home repairs for people with with volunteer labor. And he said, I've got a great project in mind for you, and I have this client, and she needs to have her porch roof taken off and reshingled, and you can totally do it with volunteers in an afternoon. It's going to be great. To warn you in advance, he did say, the client is a tiny bit of an animal hoarder. And I was like, you know, no worries. I mean, John Edwards, he is a man of the people. He loves animal hoarders. This is going to be great. It's not going to be an issue. Not going to be an issue at all. So the day of the project dawned, you know, bright and sunny and perfect for this volunteer project. And I showed up early to talk to Daniel's volunteer foreman, who's a seasoned roofer, who's up on the roof already checking it out. And right on time, John Edwards' convoy pulls up in this series of shiny SUVs, and out tumble all the enthusiastic student volunteers and our local state senator. And then John Edwards himself in this, you know, really crisp, brand new flannel shirt and shiny, brand new boots and legitimately amazing hair. And fairly immediately, things started to go slightly sideways. Daniel's client came out of the house trailed by like somewhere between 10 and 35 dogs. And, you know, she looked at us, and she looked at John Edwards, and she looked at the roofer who's up, you know, throwing shingles down off her porch, and she said, you know, it's really great that you guys are here to work on my roof, but I was really actually hoping that there was, you know, something that's a little more useful that I thought maybe you could do for me, maybe in addition to the roof, or, you know, maybe instead of the roof today. And she said, you know, every winter, I have a couple of dogs who don't make it, and It's really hard to bury them when the ground is frozen. And it starts to get really crowded in the freezer in my kitchen. And I'm trying to fit their bodies in there. You know, it just doesn't really work. So I was hoping that maybe you could just dig a few graves for me while you're here. You know, that would be really the best thing you could do. So to John Edwards' credit, you know, he didn't bat an eye as she showed us, like, the section of the yard that was designated as the pet cemetery, you know, nor as she summoned over the dogs that she thought, like, were, you know, maybe not going to make it through the winter. Like, so we could accurately measure, you know, the grave. And nor as she reminded us to, you know, maybe think about the effects of rigor mortis on the paws as, you know, in measuring those dimensions. Nor as the local press arrived to document the entire extravaganza. But as soon as things got real, you know, as soon as we all had our shovels and John Edwards had his shovel and we were standing there and we're, you know, marking out rectangles on the ground and we start to dig and we're having these conversations like, does rigor mortis affect a dog's tail? Like, does it need to be long? And we're calling over the dogs and they're like kind of sniffing and like peeing on their, you know, future grave sites and we're like, you know, trying to measure them without, you know, making them feel bad about their prospects for living through the winter. Then John Edwards was out. He was done. He somehow found a piece of wood. I'm not really sure how, because neither of the projects that we had been tasked with actually involved wood. But he found a board, and he took one end, and our state senator took the other end, and they started just prancing around in a circle in front of the client's house. You know, they held the board on their shoulders, and they posed, and like, snap, 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 snap. The local press took pictures of them, and they held the board over their heads like they were participating in some kind of primitive barn raising, and, you know, snap, 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 snap. The local press took pictures, and on this went with us digging, and the dogs, like, frolicking and kind of jumping over the graves and, like, sniffing them and going in and out, and Edwards and our state senator just, like, walking around in a circle doing stuff with this piece of wood. And then, so about halfway through the afternoon, Edwards' convoy returned, ostensibly just to make sure that he was going to be able to get out of there on time to make it to his presentation at the college that evening. And, you know, he took one last look at us digging the graves and one last look at the dogs and one last look at this piece of wood. And he was just completely done. And he threw down the board and he rounded up all his volunteers and he stuck them in his SUVs and he grabbed the state senator and he hit the road, leaving three dogs with, you know, mostly finished final resting places and a woman with no porch roof. And Daniel and I with a lot of work to finish up that afternoon. And at the time, I thought, you know, this is politics as usual. You know, I mean, John Edwards is a busy guy. Like, maybe he just doesn't have time to dig a grave for every dog, you know? But later on, when everything else came out about him, I thought, you know, sometimes if you can't be trusted with the small stuff, you really can't be trusted with the big stuff either. So, thanks.
That was Becky Wint Pearson, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
That's all for this show. Thanks for celebrating 7 years of Arctic Entries with us.
To hear these stories again, or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
Our website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way.
The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our site.
Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo. And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.